Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire Healthcare Association, representing the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for our most vulnerable citizens. This is the show that's all about New Hampshire politics, and we had Beto O'Rourke in the Granite State for the last 3 days, and Paul and I both spoke with him on separate occasions. We'll hear those conversations in just a moment. Also, Cory Booker reacts to Beto being in the race a little bit later. Julian Castro talks about that and the evolution of this race as well. But, Paul, first, your takeaways after spending 3 days with Beto O'Rourke.
I'm tired. That's the first one. Beto mania is for real, right? We hadn't experienced it yet. Iowa got a taste of it. Some parts of the Midwest got a taste of it as well. But he's for real, and the excitement around him, yeah, seems for real. Listen, he had large crowds at just about every stop, and he hit all 10 counties. That's pretty impressive in 48 hours. Eight major events, and he did two smaller off-the-record events as well. So all 10 counties, that's a real breakneck pace. He's got, of course, you experienced it as well, seeing him in action. He's got a kind of informal, natural, conversational way about him. He does have that charisma that we've heard about, no doubt about that. I mean, you saw that with the crowds, the energy. And when it comes to policy, he's getting better every day.
Yeah, there's an authenticity about Beto O'Rourke where he is able to connect with voters in a one-on-one level. There's a passion to everything that he does. And what doesn't come through necessarily on television at times definitely comes through when you are with him in the room. There's a palpable buzz. But, of course, most people are never going to meet Beto O'Rourke across the country. He has to find a way to resonate on television, have that come across as well in debate formats and interviews and such. My big question for Beto was about, he places a lot of discussion about the gravity of this moment. And what about Beto O'Rourke makes him the best individual to lead us in this moment was what I talked to him about.
You talked a lot about the gravity of this moment in time. What about you and your skill set uniquely qualifies you in this moment in your view?
So I'm a small business owner. In the late 1990s with good friends, we started a business that created high-tech, high-value, high-skill, high-wage jobs in a community that didn't have enough of them. So I know what it's like to create jobs, to meet a payroll, to build something in a community that needs the investment. I served on a nonpartisan city council where we were neither Republicans or Democrats. We were all Passoans responsible for getting something done for our constituents. And we did year in, year out. Served in Congress, where expanding mental health care for veterans, protecting public lands in Texas, investing in our ports of entry so that we facilitated more trade, more job growth, and more security at the same time. All of that only possible by reaching across, walking across the aisle, and finding some common ground, and then campaigning in what was thought to be a state too red for a Democrat, not only almost winning, but helping many others to win their races, bringing many others into our democracy, and changing the face of politics, and all the while not demeaning anybody, trying to elevate the civility of our conversations and bring everyone in, not taking a dime from a single PAC, and making it all about people. So those are some of the things that I can bring to bear, as well as coming from the U.S.-Mexico border. At a time that the U.S.-Mexico border dominates so much of the national conversation, I have a profoundly positive story to tell about the people of the border, about communities of immigrants, and the future of this country.
But you as an individual, as a person, what about you in this particular time makes you the individual that would resonate and create an environment which people would be advantageous from it?
I mean, I guess I'm trying to describe myself by those things that I've been able to be a part of, the things that I've been able to accomplish. The voters are going to have to decide after they've had a chance to meet me, listen to me, ask me their questions, see the way in which I campaign, whether I meet the needs of this country at this moment. And it's their judgment, their wisdom, and their votes that will ultimately decide this, and I'm grateful for that. I'm just going to do everything in my power to meet as many of them as I possibly can, and do that throughout this campaign.
Do you think there needs to be a generational shift, though, from the generation of individuals who are in their 70s to individuals who are younger, perhaps represent America better?
I leave that to people to decide. All I can do is offer my experience as a small business owner, my experience as a public servant in the Congress, every year of it in the minority, forced to work across the aisle to get anything done, my experience running in what was thought to be a red state. And though we lost narrowly in that election, we were able to be part of a movement that elected many more to offices, from city council and commissioners' courts to judicial positions and seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So I just think we need more people in the democratic process. We took a state, or helped to take a state, that ranked 50th in voter turnout to a state that had a 500% increase in young voter turnout in 2018. So whatever your age or experience or story, I want you involved in this democratic process, because if our democracy fails at this critical moment, it will fail all of us and the generations who follow us. So I'm all about bringing everyone in, regardless of age or any other difference.
You proposed a universal pre-K here at the event here. How do you go about paying for a program like that and some of the other programs that you have pushed forth that you're interested in?
So these investments in universal pre-K, in the quality of our public education, in the accessibility of higher education, should be seen as investments. It's going to cause us to spend more upfront, but we will see a much greater return economically in taxes paid down the road from people who are earning far more than they would have otherwise. If we ask the very wealthiest to pay a greater share of their wealth into this country's ability to create wealth for everyone, if we stop spending our way into ever greater levels of debt, if you look at the $2 trillion in tax cuts that flowed disproportionately to corporations and the wealthy, if you look at the George W. tax cuts before that, and the wars we're fighting all over the world and the countries we are forced to rebuild after we've invaded them, you begin to see some of the savings we could realize if we took a different path, savings that would allow us to invest in people and in communities, in education, and produce a much greater return than the way that we're spending money in some cases right now.
You were asked about late-term abortions just before. I'm wondering specifically, if you had won the election last November and if you were in the U.S. Senate a couple days ago, how would you have voted on that bill?
I would have listened to the women that I wanted to represent in the state of Texas. I would have listened to doctors and medical providers. I would have looked at the facts and understood the truth. And then I would have voted with those women to make their own decisions about their own bodies.
That's
Beto O'Rourke there from Plymouth State. You know, later that day, he was at another university, University of New Hampshire in Durham, another very large crowd for him. Afterward, again, another avail with reporters. Very impressive. He did one at every formal stop, which you don't see most candidates do. So he's definitely opening up the access to reporters after some criticism in Iowa that he wasn't doing enough interaction with reporters. I asked him about the Electoral College because he's become one of the latest Democrats running for the White House who's now calling for scrapping or considering scrapping the Electoral College. Of course, we all remember what happened in 2016 when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, did not win the electoral vote, Donald Trump becomes president.
Same thing with Al Gore and George W. Bush.
Yes, we have a couple cases of this in our recent history. That may not play well, though, scrapping the Electoral College in New Hampshire. Why? Because we see general election traffic from the candidates because we are a small state, but we're an important state. We're a battleground state. I asked O'Rourke about it, and here's what he said.
Yeah, it's not a popular issue here in New Hampshire. I mean, this state is a battleground state in the general election. If you take away the Electoral College, why would any general election candidate come here? They'll be in California and Texas.
Yeah.
And Florida.
Yeah, yeah. I think that candidates who are going to be successful now and in the future are going to show up everywhere, regardless of how many votes are cast, how rural, how urban. It's not just important for those communities of smaller populations or those states of smaller populations. The folks who live in the big cities want to know that you're doing this differently and that you really want to represent and serve everyone. When we went to the smallest counties in Texas, it resonated not just there, but it did in Austin and Dallas and Houston as well. So recognize that this may not be universally popular and may be less popular in some places, but if we really want to get the full genius of this country of more than 320 million, we're going to make sure that everyone's vote really counts.
O'Rourke started his trip in Keene State, another college. There he goes again at a college, getting a very big crowd. Smart move by him. And earlier that day, Bernie Sanders, one of the top contenders right now for the Democratic nomination, announced that he would be allowing his campaign to unionize, the first time in presidential campaign history. I asked O'Rourke if he would follow suit.
Yesterday, Bernie Sanders said he was unionizing his campaign. First time anyone has done that. Is that something you would consider for your campaign?
Absolutely. If those who work on this campaign and who comprise what I hope will be the largest grassroots effort this nation has ever seen want to unionize, I support that all the way. In the meantime, I'm going to make sure that we pay among, if not the highest wages, that everyone who works on the campaign is paid a living wage, excellent health care, child care, so that everyone can work whatever their conditions are. But if these employees also want to unionize, I absolutely support them.
A couple of days before Beto Mania hit New Hampshire, Cory Booker had a very popular 3-2-1. A couple of days before Beto Mania hit New Hampshire, Cory Booker, another rival for the nomination, the senator from New Jersey, was here for a jam-packed 24-hour trip. And I asked him about O'Rourke and whether it was a lot of flash or some substance.
But talking about Beto O'Rourke, has it been a little bit much? Is the Beto Mania, the Vanity Fair article, the coverage, is it just a little bit much?
Again, the focus should not be, and I learned this when I was running track in high school, you're in your lane, don't look at the person to your left and right, focus on the hurdles ahead of you. And for me, it's all about connecting with voters. And I feel like if I can do that and let people know where my heart is, what my vision for the country is, what my ideas are, I can compel people to join me and work hard with me in winning this presidency and this presidential run.
Yeah, and you can see right there, Chris, Cory Booker did not want to talk about Beto O'Rourke.
No, and I don't think any of the candidates want to talk about one another at this point in time, but they will in very short order.
Because he's changing. He is changing the race right now, let's be honest. The race has changed with his entry. It'll change again when Joe Biden gets in, but it has changed.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. We return here on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Hit the road once again to Bedford to talk with Jay Inslee and Manchester for Julian Castro. You're listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. This past weekend, Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, made his first trip to the Granite State as an official candidate for president. I caught up with him at a house party in Bedford.
So we're out on the campaign trail here in Bedford, joined by the governor of Washington, Jay Inslee. And your candidacy is so intriguing to me because you are a happy warrior, a guy who is coming out and talking about the issues in a way that has humor, but your message is one that is extremely dire, and you were talking about potential extinction of humanity. How do you kind of combine those two, and how dangerous a time period do you think we live in? I mean, you said the next president of the United States is going to determine whether or not, you know, humans essentially survive down the road.
Well, I think this is a moment that calls all of us to respond to two parts of our personalities: one, recognizing reality and the challenge, and two, having confidence that we are confident enough to take action. Certainly the challenge of climate change is unfortunately a crisis. The scientific community has made clear that we have very few years to act, and this is a clear scientific reality. And the depth of the challenge is really difficult to comprehend, but I've seen it firsthand. I've been to Paradise, California. This is a town of 25,000 people that was essentially wiped off the face of the map. We've seen floods across the United States, in Houston and Cedar Rapids in Iowa. In Miami Beach, I've seen the fact that they have to raise their streets because they're flooded already, the Fish and Main Street. So we have to understand the depth of this that really will degrade the chance for our grandchildren to live a meaningful and healthy life. At the same time, we have not to be frozen into passivity and action. And that means that we have to be optimistic. We have to hew to our can-do nature as a people. And we have to rise to the challenge like we did in defeating fascism and going to the moon. We have to seize those, what I would call the hidden energies of our hearts, and unleash those. And I think a president can help America do that.
Beto O'Rourke described the individuals that are fighting climate change as essentially being the Americans who were taking the beach at Normandy. I thought there was a little bit of hyperbole there, given the nature of that. What were your takeaways from those comments? Do you think it's important as well, you know, to be serious in your remarks? Because if you say something like that about individuals fighting climate change, it's easy to for individuals to push that aside and say, these people are not serious if you're saying something like that.
Well, I'm more for action rather than rhetoric.
Yeah.
And the action I've taken is several. Number one, I'm the only candidate who has said very clearly beating climate change has to be the first priority of the United States. It has to be the first, foremost, and paramount duty of the United States. And the reason it's important to commit to that is that if it is not job one, it will not get done.
Right.
I'm the candidate who's been fighting this for 20 years. I'm the candidate who's co-authored a book about it. I'm the candidate who has helped found the U.S. Climate Alliance. So I have a unique position both on action we've done, and we've actually got things done. I'm the candidate who's actually got things done fighting climate change in the state of Washington. So I think the combination of the recognizing it has to be job one, my success in fighting it in my state, and the vision statement I will have that's consistent with the optimistic can-do nature, that's a winning message in America. And people understand that. Look, in Iowa, this was, amongst Democrats, the number one highest priority, tied with health care. This is a magic moment. It is our moment.
In your remarks, you mentioned the difficulty in winning an argument with Republicans in regards to this because of the fact that many, you acknowledge that our governor here in the state of New Hampshire, do not even fully believe in climate change. So when you have to get to 60 votes in the Senate to pass a measure of this nature, how do you go about convincing Republicans they're skeptical? Because to me, it's the economic side of things, that you can push forth an argument in regards to what needs to be done with a 21st century economy and a potential green economy. So how do you win over, as an individual who's been in Congress and has gotten things done as governor, how do you win over individuals that are skeptical about even what you're telling them?
Well, we have to face a reality that the Republican Party at the moment is in total thrall of Donald Trump, who says climate change is a Chinese hoax. And as long as that party has that attitude, it's very difficult to find a way to get them to be productive. So we have to do what is obvious, which is to remove the filibuster. The filibuster is an absolute stop sign to any meaningful progress on climate change.
Right.
And when the world is on fire, we cannot allow an antebellum, antiquated, archaic rule that is not in the U.S. Constitution to block something that can save our humanity and our civilization. We can't allow that. So the civilization needs to go the way of the dodo bird. It's way beyond its usefulness. And I am the only candidate, and this is somewhat shocking to me, actually, that I'm the only candidate who is saying that right now. You have these senators who want to cling to this senatorial privilege. You can't be serious about fighting climate change unless you're willing to say the filibuster has to go. I am willing to do that because I understand how critical this is.
A gentleman asked you about raising the gas tax 20 cents a gallon. And the gas tax is kind of the third rail of the middle class economy in that individuals never want to see their gas prices rise. Will you commit to not raising a gas tax to fight this? Or do you see raising the gas tax president rate since 1992 as being an important measure to implement the policies that you wish to implement?
Well, I've been a governor of building the most successful economy in the United States. My state has the greatest GDP growth, the biggest wage growth, and the best job creation. I think that's a template for the rest of the country. And that includes building transportation infrastructure. It includes putting thousands of people to work in a $70 billion transportation infrastructure package. They have built not even a birdhouse in Washington, D.C. Under Donald Trump. So I believe we have to build that infrastructure. I believe it's good for job creation. And if you believe in a growing America, you ought to believe in building bridges and trains and new systems of high-tech transportation and giving people more access for cars as well. And we're going to start driving a lot more electric cars, by the way. In my state, we're helping people get electric cars. So if you're going to do that, you have to be willing to make that investment. I'm willing to do that.
Following on rural workers, we have seen President Trump have significant success with rural workers, has had significant success with rural workers, particularly in the last election, but has not delivered on items such as you mentioned in regards to infrastructure.
Right.
How do you go about swaying Trump voters away from Trump, or do you worry just about the majority of voters in this country, which could lead to electoral success? Do you go at Trump voters and speak to them directly, or do you look at the plurality of voters that are in a different direction?
Well, I intend to to connect with Americans who have felt economic anxiety, for one reason or another, did not feel that we had a vision statement that helped them in 2016. But I intend to do what we did in 2018, which is to flip 7 governorships. I was chair of the National Democratic Governors Association. We flipped 7 seats from red to blue, and it's because I worked with our candidates that created a vision statement of what I call meat and potato politics. Putting people to work, building roads, putting people to work, having decent schoolhouses, having better education. These kind of messages resonated with people and connected to their economic anxiety. And the clean energy message around jobs creation is perhaps the most promising one, because I can go into communities like in Michigan. Look, I'm driving a little shiny blue General Motors Bolt made in Michigan by American workers. I was arguing with Megan McCain about this on The View the other day. Yep. She says, well, you got to get rid of your cars. And I said, well, that's funny. I had a car made in Michigan that drives on electricity, made by Michigan workers. That's the kind of vision statement that I intend to bring, and I think there's every reason to believe we'll be successful.
Governor, great to see you.
Thank you.
That is Washington Governor Jay Inslee. Julian Castro is one of the first individuals to get into the race, but has not received a lion's share of attention. He got into the race back in January, and it was an event in Manchester at the Bookery when we sat down.
Joined by former Housing and Urban Development Secretary and San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro here in Manchester. Bookery, a nice spot on Elm Street. Always love getting out on the campaign trail. What is the sense that you get for this race? It seems like as soon as anyone gets in, there's a huge splash, and that kind of takes up a couple of weeks, and then another person gets in. Do you think that once we get to the summer months, that is going to be the time period where we get a true sense for this field and how individuals are positioning themselves?
There's a life cycle that these campaigns have, and there are phases within that cycle. We're very early. We have about 47 weeks until New Hampshire votes. So what I'm trying to do is just to get out there to these early states, including New Hampshire, and to deliver a strong, powerful message about the vision for the future of our country, that everybody counts, that we're going to restore integrity and honor to the White House, that I would be a president for all Americans, and that I have the executive experience and the track record of getting things done that I believe people are looking for in 2020. And so I'm just focusing on building a strong campaign right now, and I can tell that we're picking up momentum little by little. And I know right now that I'm not the front runner, but I didn't grow up the front runner at any point in my life, and there are a lot of folks out there who don't feel like front runners. I'm going to go and speak to them and about what we're going to do so that all Americans can prosper in the years to come. And I'm confident that I will be the front runner by the time the voting starts.
Your friend Beto O'Rourke from Texas is going to be here in New Hampshire later this week. And you know, he has gotten into the race, and there's been a lot of discussion about him and a lot of focus on him. But it seems as though there's perhaps not as much substance with him as with other presidential candidates who are not getting perhaps the attention that they deserve. He said he was born to be in it. He talked about the rationale for running for president, some of it being having to do household chores around his children. Is there a frustration on your part and on perhaps, I guess you can only speak for yourself, but other candidates' part where here is this individual that everyone is kind of fawning over, and here I am putting my head down, doing the work, and have put a resume together and have significant accomplishments, and this individual is receiving all the attention?
You know, the voters are going to sort that out. What I'm going to focus on is my own campaign and doing all of the hard work that it takes to connect with the voters here in New Hampshire. I think they're going to see that I have a track record of getting things done, that I have the kind of executive experience that would make me a great president, and that I have a compelling vision for the future of our country to become the smartest, the healthiest, the fairest, and the most prosperous nation in the 21st century, and that I've been concrete and specific about what it's going to take to get there.
One of the cool things about this campaign, and it's so early on, is that you delve beneath the surface and the buzz, and I see one of the more substantive campaigns that has ever been materialized. The issues that are being talked about, this forum here focusing on issues that middle class families are facing. You know, Elizabeth Warren rolling out significant policy initiatives. Kirsten Gillibrand was talking about water and water issues. I cannot recall a campaign that is this substantive and dealing with the issues of everyday Americans in the way that it is. Why do you think that that this campaign has brought this about, where there's obviously there's a vile nature of what's taking place in the vitriol, but beneath the surface there is significant discussions about important issues?
Yeah, I think what you've seen is that a lot of the candidates have been very substantive, and because people know that it's time to get down to business, that there's been an absence of leadership over the last 2 years. At the same time, you have rents that are going up all across places like New Hampshire. We were in Portsmouth earlier. That's a good example. Today we talked about the fact that people need a paid family and medical leave because they have an adult aging parent to take care of or children to take care of. We have issues that intimately impact the quality of life and the ability to prosper for Americans across the country. And let's focus on that and instead of what Trump would like us to focus on, which is just the insults and the style and the pettiness of politics.
There's significant questions as to how we get to these solutions and what also can be accomplished given the nature of Congress at this point in time. And talking with Jay Inslee the other day, his focus is on climate, and he feels that he only has the political capital for one significant issue, to get through a Congress, even if it's controlled by Democrats, given the filibuster power in the Senate, and they have to get to 60 votes. Do you feel that way as well? Can you accomplish a broad agenda that goes across many different lines, or do you have to focus specifically on, a middle-class revolutionary package or something of that nature? Can you do multiple things, or does there need to be a significant focus that you push forth as a candidate?
Well, I'm convinced that all of these dots are connected. Healthcare, education, infrastructure, climate change. And so I believe that on January 20th, 2021 at 12:01 p.m., we're going to have a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House. And the lesson of 93, 94, and 2009, 2010 is don't wait. So it's time to move forward with an agenda that makes life better for families across the board in this country in all of those different ways. And that would be my goal, not to dream little, but to dream big and to work toward big accomplishments.
Secretary Castro, it's always great to see you.
Okay, good to see you.
That is Julian Castro. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We sat down for a special Pints and Politics Road to the White House St. Patrick's Day edition with Seth Moulton, a congressman from Massachusetts, at the Barley House.
You mentioned the division in our nation, but there's also tremendous division within your party. We're seeing that during the course of this campaign, where mostly everything is moving very far to the left, and progressives have also taken over to a large extent your body down in Congress as well. Is that a concern that you have, that the party and the country is perhaps moving too far from the mainstream and in your individual beliefs, and is that a rationale for running?
Well, I think the press really exaggerates the divisions in our party. I mean, we're a majority party now. We should have the majority of ideas, and that means a diversity of ideas representing people from all over this country. You know, if you think about it, we've had some real debates over health care, for example, whether Medicare for All is the right solution. But fundamentally, all Democrats want to make sure that everybody in America has access to health care. We're just debating how to get there. You know, we want to make sure that every American has cheaper prescription drugs. And we're going to have a good debate about how to get there. What a change from last year in Congress when we had the Republicans just debating about how to take health care away from Americans every single day. So Democrats are fundamentally united in our ideas. We're just going to have a vigorous debate about what policies we need to get there. I'd also point out, though, that the folks who won the majority in the House, they're people who won in Trump districts. They're people who flipped districts from Republican to Democrat. So those are the people who actually expanded our party, and leaders like Mikey Sherrill down in New Jersey, like Chrissy Houlihan in Pennsylvania. People like that are driving the debate, and they're going to be leaders in our party's future.
Dean?
Sure. Congressman, I'd like to maybe have you expand a little bit more on your position on health care to give our listeners a sense of where you are on the spectrum from Medicare for all to single payer to let's fix Obamacare, but let's preserve the integrity of the private insurance markets. Where are you? Do you have a sense of where you are in that continuum?
Absolutely. I think Medicare should be an option for everybody, but I don't think you should be forced out of your private health care plan if that's what you want. And I speak to that as someone who has single-payer health care because I made a commitment when I got elected to continue getting my own health care at the VA, at least until we can fix it for veterans, because I think veterans deserve the best health care in the world. And yet, as I can tell you from my own experience at the VA, they're not getting it. The VA does some things well, and I have a great primary care physician. I go there regularly for appointments, but they also sent me home with the wrong medications after I got surgery, shortly after I was sworn in. And, of course, you have other stories of veterans literally dying on waiting lists for the VA. So I know what single-payer health care is like, and it's not perfect. But should it be an option? It should be an option for everybody. And should that option compete against the private sector and potentially drive down the cost and drive the bad actors in private health care out of business? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Two quick follow-ups. Some candidates in the Democratic field have suggested maybe moving the age for Medicare down to 50. So how would you feel about that? And the second question is, we've had issues here in New Hampshire with the VA, and there's been a debate in the state about whether to invest a lot of money in revitalizing the Manchester VA, the hospital, or working on giving veterans better options in the surrounding community. So going into the private choice. Where are you on those two issues?
Sure. So on the first one, moving the Medicare age down is absolutely a step in the right direction. Because again, we want to make Medicare an option for everybody. And that's a good first step. In terms of the VA, the bottom line is this. Veterans deserve the best health care in the world. And if you can get that at the VA and veterans want to go to the VA, let's not forget, veterans don't want the VA to go away.
Right. Some like the VA. Actually.
Well, the majority do. A lot do. I mean, I like the VA. They do things well. I just want to make sure they're doing things better. So that should be an option. But if the best option for your health care is a private provider, hey, the bottom line is veterans deserve the best care. And if you can get it better in the private sector, then we should make sure they can.
Congressman, there was a time when a decorated Marine, somebody had served his country, as you have, somebody who's demonstrated a willingness to work across the aisle, was straight out of central casting to run for president. And so I see what might be partly behind the drive here. What's left for you to consider before you make that decision to go all in?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is, I mean, I take the quip about out of central casting, but this is not where I expected to be. I mean, I didn't study politics in school. I didn't expect to be in this position. I didn't even plan to run for Congress back when I got out of the Marines. But the reason I ran in that first race back in 2014 was because I said, you know what, if this doesn't change, if no one's willing to challenge the establishment, then it's not going to get any better. And no one today looks at government, looks at Washington, the White House, anywhere and says, okay, they're doing a great job. Yeah, they're really knocking it out of the park. So you got to be willing to stand up to the system and change the system. But when I took on that 18-year incumbent in Massachusetts back in 2014, everybody in the Massachusetts political establishment was against me. I mean, everybody told me, not only are you going to lose Moulton, but you'll never be involved in Massachusetts politics again because you dared to challenge the establishment. And fundamentally what they were saying to me was, Seth, do not participate in the democracy you just risked your life to defend. And that's wrong. We need to get more people to participate in our democracy. We need to make sure that every vote in America counts. And whether or not this is the right way for me to serve the country now is fundamentally how I'll look at this decision. You know, it's not about just a horse race with other people or anything. It's how can I best serve the country, and can I reach more Americans to bring this country back together after the most divisive presidency in American history?
Sure. Do you have a timeline in mind?
The next month.
The next month. Okay.
I'll make a decision within the next month.
That's great. You're going to be getting into a race, as Chris noted, with a lot of candidates. Folks like us tend to...
Wayne's quick to jump the gun. You're going to be getting in.
You're going to be getting in. Okay.
You almost jumped the gun a little bit earlier.
There could be a lot of... there are a lot of candidates should you decide to jump into the race. Folks like us take a look at it, and we try to put folks in lanes, the progressive lane, the moderate lane, whatever that is. Do you consider yourself a progressive Democrat?
I'm progressive on a lot of issues. And, you know, I mean, I was one of the first to sign on to the Green New Deal because I think climate change is important, for example. Now, I'm going to be talking about what I think the key components of the Green New Deal should be. I signed on when it was an empty vessel. But I'm going to lead on issues like that. I'm going to lead on voting rights. I've called for electoral college reform and abolishing the filibuster, which hardly any other candidates call for, because that's the kind of reform we need in our government. I went out and I fought for a new generation of leadership on the campaign trail last cycle. And through my organization, Serve America, we backed this incredible group of veterans running across the country. All young people who have served the country before and want to serve the country again. And we were a huge part of taking back the House. So I'm going to fight on progressive issues, but I don't prescribe to labels or whatnot, you know. And I think that we got to make sure that we reach all Americans. The Green New Deal is great, but it's got to make we got to make sure we don't leave Americans behind.
One of those individuals that you supported is Maura Sullivan, who ran for Congress in a very contested first congressional district race and eventually lost to Chris Pappas. Is there some concern that you alienated potential Democratic primary voters with that support for Sullivan?
No, you know, when I came up and spoke to a group in New Hampshire a few weeks ago, there were a lot of Chris Pappas supporters there. Okay. And let's be clear, Chris is doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's doing a fantastic job representing the district. But Maura is a good friend. She's a fellow Marine, and the district literally borders mine. So I wasn't going to support folks in Kentucky and New Jersey and California and not support my friend in New Hampshire. And that's the kind of principled look, I take to politics. You know, I'm not afraid to fight tough political fights, and I'm not afraid to lose. But I thought it was the right thing to do, and now I'm proud to support Chris, and I supported him in the general election and helped make sure he got over the finish line.
It's Seth Moulton joining us for Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, special St. Patrick's Day edition. I noticed you are wearing shamrocks on your socks, so you're all in the St. Patrick's Day spirit.
In the subtle green jacket, Chris. You know.
That's very subtle green.
Credit where credit
one might
Chris
call it brown. One might call it brown. Well, for you, we'll call it subtle green. And we're here at the Barley House, this presented by New England College. One of the areas, and Wayne talked about lanes, and you know, I think we are too much into labels, but it's not going to stop me from going into labels. In this field, I do not see many individuals, Pete Buttigieg perhaps is an individual who could do this as well, but can make an argument in regards to Donald Trump's foreign policy from perspective that you can. And, you know, I'm curious as to how you see the president's foreign policy and how you evaluate that foreign policy, and if that is the area where you view yourself having the best expertise out of anybody in the field, who you may not be in the field currently, but you could perhaps obviously be in the next couple weeks.
Well, the commander-in-chief is an utter disaster, and he's putting this country at risk. And I think most Americans know that. I think they see it around the globe, whether it's in Syria, where the Secretary of Defense just resigned over the president's Syria policy, in North Korea, where he nearly started a war, and then patted himself on the back for saving ourselves from the war that he almost started, whether it's failing to stand up to Russia, as it literally undermines our democracy, or failing to really confront the rise of China. We're talking about building a border wall on the southern border when we should be building a cyber wall to stop China from stealing our businesses.
Right.
So this president has been a failure at every step of the way. And part of the job description of the president of the United States is being effective commander-in-chief. It's making those solemn decisions about whether to send young men and women, young Americans, to risk their lives for our country. The experience that I had in Iraq in the midst of a war I disagreed with informs a lot of where I am now. I mean, I wouldn't be here as a member of Congress if not for that experience. It was mm-hmm. the first time in my life that I really felt like America has let us down, really felt betrayed by my country. And I know a lot of Americans, a lot of troops feel let down by Donald Trump, feel betrayed by Donald Trump.
How did you balance those two things? Serving your country and disagreeing with the war? Because I think there are a number of individuals who are in the same boat as you were in. How do you serve your nation and put yourself forward in as positive a way as possible each day while also fundamentally disagreeing with the war you're fighting?
It was hard. It was really hard, and it was especially hard being a platoon commander there, where I didn't have to just serve myself. I had to get a whole bunch of Americans from all over this country, you know, with different religious beliefs, different political beliefs from states across the land, to get united behind a single mission. I think that's fundamentally the job of the commander-in-chief, is to get a whole bunch of Americans with a lot of different beliefs, different political perspectives, different religious beliefs, to get united behind a single mission. But when you're in a war and you're not even sure about that mission,
mm-hmm.
it is hard. What made me proud to be there was two things. One, I knew that no one was going in my place, because that's the way wars work. It's not like if you quit, they just leave that hole empty. You know, someone else is going to fill that spot. And the second thing is that every single day on the ground in Iraq, I was able to have an impact on how that war was fought, and fundamentally just an impact on other people's lives, on the lives of fellow Marines, on the lives of Iraqis who were there. That sense of purpose that every one of us had, even though we disagreed with the war, even though many of us disagreed with the war, is something that is something I'll never forget. And as disenchanting as the war was, it was an inspiring experience to be able to serve.
That is Seth Moulton. You can check out that complete Pints and Politics at our website, nhtalkradio.com. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is looking at running for president and was in Concord this past weekend. I talked with him at the Common Man.
If you look at this field, there's obviously 15 presidential candidates that are already in. What about your skill set allows you to think that you'll bring something different to this race and have a chance at success?
I'm just going to make that a general question because I'm not a candidate at this point. And I'm not here to campaign or compare against other candidates. I'm here to talk about issues and what we're doing in New York. Look, the bottom line is, I believe people want a progressive vision of change. I really do. But they need to know it's going to actually happen. They need to know there's something behind it. And, you know, I represent 8.6 million people. I lead them. I govern them. And we've been able to make really big, substantial changes that are affecting people's lives right now. They're not policy papers. They're actual, living, breathing changes in people's lives. Pre-K for All is a great example. Or getting paid sick leave to 500,000 more people. That I think New Hampshire voters are, you know, along with our Iowan brothers and sisters, the best interviewers, the best vetters in the country. They want to make sure people not only have good ideas, but the ability to get them done. So, look, I'm going to be offering these ideas any way you slice it. I want people to hear these things can happen. But I think one of the things you're going to see here is the bar is going to be high for proof. And it's going to be high for proof, I think, later on in the general election, because people have seen all over this country what it was like to have a president with no experience governing and running a government, and it's been very destructive. I think there will be some yearning for candidates who can prove they know how to run something big and difficult.
Individuals care about issues here, but they also care about defeating Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
In your view, how do you go about doing that? What is the blueprint? Do you engage? Do you not engage? Do you take a higher road? How do you get in the dirt with Donald Trump or just ascend beyond it?
I think, you know, as a New Yorker, there's nothing about Donald Trump's approach that ever surprises me. And you don't fixate on him. You don't make him the issue. That doesn't work. Talk about what we're going to do for working people. But also, don't be afraid for a moment to fight back. You know, he tried, when it came to my city, he tried to cut off our funding for security programs because we don't ask immigrants their immigration status, right? He was said, oh, because of that, we're going to come and take away your money. We said, no, you're not. We'll see you in court, and we're going to beat you. What you're doing is unconstitutional. Well, we stood up to him. We didn't change anything about what we were doing, and we beat him in court. I think that is the kind of thing people need to see, that leaders will stand up to them, but not fixate on them. What we need to fixate is what we're going to do for working people. And I don't think that was done in 2016. I think we got to do it in 2020. We got to have a clear, progressive, populist vision of change for working people. If we have that, our voters will turn out, Democratic voters will turn out, progressive voters will turn out, but I also think we'll reach some Trump voters who are just looking for change in their lives, and they're looking for a better chance to make ends meet. They want to hear that. They haven't heard it enough from Democrats in the past.
In conclusion, you were followed by the New York City Press, Daily News and everything else.
Yeah.
And there's a scrutiny that comes along with that, which can both be a positive and a negative for a presidential campaign, as we've seen in the past. How do you reconcile that, where your record is looked at the way that it is? But is that scrutiny something that makes you a better candidate potentially?
Unquestionably, look, as a question of just being analytical here, because I'm not a candidate yet, there's no question it makes you a better candidate. First of all of the scrutiny, all of the evaluation makes you stronger personally. Second of all, there's no surprises with me. I've been scrubbed and scrubbed again now for 6 years, mm-hmm. if you include my election year. Mm-hmm. And it's fair to say there are some people running who've never been through anything like that. I mean, third of all, it resembles some of what you're going to find if you're blessed enough to win an election mm-hmm. for president. You're going to go through the ringer. It's, you know, the toughest job in the world. Some people have said mayor of New York City is the second hardest mm-hmm. job, you know. And I think the scrutiny is good. I don't have any question about the fact that I've been vetted.
Is there a timetable?
No, I've said sooner rather than later.
That is Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City. Author and spiritual healer Marianne Williamson is running for president. She spent a few days here in the Granite State and sat down with us for Pints and Politics at the Barley House. Here's Dean Spiliotis.
Would you be comfortable engaging ISIS militarily in order to protect women, or is there some other strategy in that arena that would lead towards the peace that you see?
First of all, I want to address this whole idea that a loving woman is somehow not tough enough to be commander-in-chief.
Well, that was my initial question, because that
well,
could
I know,
be the perception.
And I hadn't gotten around to that yet, and you asked another question.
Sure.
I, when you look at the situation here in the United States, and you look how many fathers have abandoned their children, and you don't see anywhere near the same number of mothers, we have made very clear throughout history, and we make clear throughout the United States right now, we will do anything for our children. No one should doubt my ability as a mother. No one should doubt my conviction. No one should doubt my commitment. And I think this would be true of any woman. We're just as tough as men. You mess with our children, we're going to mess with you. In fact, a common anthropological characteristic of every advanced mammalian species that survives and thrives is the fierce behavior of the adult female of that mm-hmm. species when she senses the mm-hmm. threat to her cubs. You look at the mama bear, the lion, the tiger, you come after her cubs, she's coming after you. And that is how human women feel in our hearts. And that I would bring that sentiment.
Yeah, and for me, just to be clear, it's not a function from the question was not a function of your gender. It was a function of my sense of your writings and some of your past.
Dennis Kucinich had a very similar approach.
Exactly. So that's what I was trying to get at. Some people may see that and say, well, how would she deal with ISIS, for example?
I think our most successful generals, if you look at someone like Dwight Eisenhower, what made him such a profound general was how much he hated war. Franklin Roosevelt led us through World War II, and he's one of his most famous quotes is that quote about "I hate war." Mm-hmm. To me, that's what makes military commanders the sort of deep personalities that they are. In terms of how you would engage, the world is a very complicated place, and every nation is a different situation. The one place where I have some ambivalence, I must say, has to do with the Taliban and women.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it's a very difficult decision, and I think that military decisions are among those where often the president is faced with the choice between two bad options.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of what's going on in Afghanistan today. So Americans want the troops to come home. We all would like to see that. So the U.S. government is now negotiating with the Taliban. The Taliban said that they would not allow the government of Afghanistan to be part of the negotiations. The United States, the conversation is that the U.S. is saying, we will withdraw our troops if you will promise that you will not let Afghanistan be a hotbed for al-Qaeda or ISIS. Notice there's not even a conversation about American women. Afghani women. I'm very aware. I was aware long before 9/11. I was very aware of the barbaric treatment of women by the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And I am heartbroken. I am heartbroken at what is, you know, I was speaking to some military figures, some very highly placed military figures who were talking to me about Afghanistan, and I asked that question. I said, well, given what you're saying, what the Taliban, obviously, the government of Afghanistan will not be able to stand on its own after American withdrawal. And I said, what's going to happen to the women? And there was silence. And then this man said, the women will be screwed, ma'am. To me, that is a very morally difficult issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I can't imagine situations where the use of our military in response to profound humanitarian disasters would be off the table. To protect. So to the way I see the use of the military, I see number one, when I see three things. I see number one, when the safety and security of the United States is involved. Number two, when the basic human values that the United States should stand for are involved. And third, when a basic world order, issue of world order in combination and connection with the rest of our allies is at stake, as was true in World War II.
Two things off of that. Obviously, there's the economic, there's the military engagement side of things, there's the diplomacy side of things in dealing with nations that do not meet the standards set forth by the world in regards to the treatment of human beings. Would you not engage in a economic relationship with nations that do not treat women or human beings in ways that are appropriate?
That's first of all, that's a really profound question, and I want to acknowledge that. Thank you. Because what are you going to do? Do no business with China?
Right.
Do you know what
Saudi
I'm saying?
Arabia? Yeah.
Sure. Now, I'll tell you, on Saudi Arabia, I think the fact that for the sake of $100 billion in arms sales, mm-hmm. we were willing to do that when we absolutely know, and this is even beyond the obvious murder of Khashoggi, mm-hmm. the fact that the Saudi Arabians, with the aid of our aerial support, without which they could not be prosecuting that war in Yemen, where tens of thousands of people have starved, many of whom are children, I think that this is a complete sacrifice of America's moral values, and you better believe I would not do it. When Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, said, well, you can have strategic partnerships with people who do not share your values, no, you can't. So to me, that is such an egregious. To me, if I know that that you are using that gun to murder someone, and I sell you that gun, I am complicit. So Saudi Arabia is an example. Well, absolutely, it's not a gray area. That would not happen if I were president.